Okay, tonight I want to pick up where we left off in the 2 Corinthians. We left off in chapter 8 in 2 Corinthians. Chapter 8 and 9, Paul really gets into detail in terms of handling a gift of money that was going to be set aside for the church in Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, it was the last chapter of the 1 Corinthians where Paul had mentioned the fact that he wanted to take up a collection for the Christian church in Jerusalem because they were suffering a great deal of persecution. And there was, as a matter of fact, according to Acts, there was a famine at the time down there. And he was making an appeal to the churches in Macedonia, and also I think he made an appeal to the Corinthians church. If they wouldn't mind setting aside some monetary funds, a collection for, you know, these people down there. And to me, it's a classic example of how God will orchestrate things for His honor and glory. In other words, the church in Jerusalem, they were primarily led by, you know, Peter, James, and John, and they were primarily a Jewish church. And the church in Jerusalem had a very difficult time in accepting the Gentile church. They believed that they could be saved, but they had a really tough time with just accepting the fact that they didn't have to adhere to all the Mosaic ceremonial laws. And they very questioned whether Gentiles were even saved because of that. And Paul, of course, was over there preaching, you know, that it's you're saved by grace through faith in Jesus Christ and not by all of these externals and Jesus Plus and so on and so forth. So anyway, long story short, God allowed a lot of difficulty and poverty and persecution to happen down in Jerusalem, as well as the famine, to put pressure on the church in such a way that when they saw the Gentile churches from, you know, Asia and Macedonia sending them money, I mean, it really had to affect them to where they said, you know, these are Gentiles who have accepted us with open arms, and they are supporting us and helping us in our time of need. And that would, I think, bring them, I don't know if the word is conviction, but they would certainly come to, I think, more of an acceptance of the Gentiles as being part of the body. And that's the thing. If you look at the body, you people who know me, I mean, ever since, I mean, day one, I don't know, we have been teaching this study for almost 31 years or so. I've lost track here, but you know, I can't ever remember a time when, you know, in all of our opening prayers that we haven't prayed for our persecuted brothers and sisters throughout the world. I mean, I have had a tremendous burden for persecuted Christians from day one. I've read so many books in regards to the things that other Christians go through because of their faith in Christ and the sufferings they go through and the kind of humiliations and persecutions and poverty that they go through. And so, you know, I always recognize them as being part of this body. And I really believe that this is what's happening here when Paul is taking up this collection for the church in Jerusalem, that God wants the church in Jerusalem to recognize that they are, you know, the Gentiles are part of this body, and that he wants the Gentiles to recognize that, hey, the Jews are the ones who are responsible for bringing us God's word to begin with. I mean, they were the ones that were, you know, through Moses and the law was given, and it was through the Jews that the Messiah was given. And so, you know, God wants people to have a mature understanding that we may be speaking different languages, being in different cultures, being on the other side of the world, but if we have the common denominator of Jesus Christ in our life, then we are that part of that body. You know, there's no question about it. And I tell you what, I mean, I don't give my little toe much thought at all. But there's times that I have stubbed that thing. And you ever notice that when you really bang it up bad that you keep banging it? I mean, it gets your attention, doesn't it? I mean, something you don't pay a whole lot of attention to. But, man, when it starts something like that, you really recognize that. That is very much part of me, you know. Anyway, let's just go ahead and start reading it, but I just want to give you a brief background of what's taking place in this chapter 8 and chapter 9, because in it, Paul sets forth, I think, some very fundamental principles as far as stewardship when it comes to money. God really has a lot to say about money and finances in a lot of different ways. I think in the book of Proverbs alone, there's probably around 40 references to finances and to money and God's attitude towards money and what he expects of us. So I think we can glean some principles from what we read in chapter 8 and chapter 9. And I think if we apply it today, it could do a great deal in terms of limiting some of the scandals that we see going on today, especially in these televangelists or, you know, these high visibility preachers who have fallen from grace because of monetary scandals. Anyway, beginning in verse 1 in chapter 8 in 2 Corinthians, it says, "Now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God, which has been given in the churches of Macedonia, that in great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord, begging us with much entreaty for their favor of participation in the support of the saints. And this is not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. Consequently, we urge Titus that as he had previously made a beginning, so he would also complete in you this gracious work as well." Now, I just kind of gave you a brief background of where this chapter is coming from, where this chapter 8 and 9 is coming from. But what it says basically here in these first few verses is that the Corinthian church had heard of the churches in Macedonia giving, taking up a collection for those in Jerusalem, and they wanted to be part of this. And they really were enthusiastic about helping out the church down in Jerusalem. And so they began to collect the money for this church, and the people there were giving really liberally. I mean, they were really being generous in what they were giving for their persecuted brothers and sisters in Jerusalem. And Paul was really, really touched by this. And he wanted Titus to make sure that he went back to Corinth to finish this work that had been started. In other words, Paul had suggested it had been started back in his first letter. And to me, that says something of significance, and that's this, that a lot of times we can have good intentions. A lot of times we can say, well, I really want to do this or do that for the Lord, or I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that for the Lord. And then it never materializes. It never gets off the ground. You never complete it, never finish it. And Paul basically is saying this, okay, we started this and we've never completed this, so Titus is going to make sure that, you know, we're going to wrap up all the loose ends and take care of this. And I just feel like here's a principle that Christians really need to, I think, assimilate into their Christian walk, and that's that, hey, good intentions are not enough. You really have to follow through. You really have to make the effort, make the sacrifice. You know, because I don't believe that just simply wishing that we could do something or wanting to do something or even intending to do something and then simply let it staying in midair and never getting around to it is going to glorify God or get anything done. There was that old fable about these two farmers were talking about, what would they do if they had a lot of money. The conversation went on something like this, where one of the guys was asking one of the farmers, well, what would you do if you had two houses? And one of the farmers said, well, if I had two houses, you know, of course I'd keep one for me and my family and my household, and then I would give the other away to a needy family, to an orphanage or something, so they could use it for whatever needs they might have. He said, well, what would you do if you had two cows? Said, well, if I had two cows, you know, I'd keep one for myself, for my family, to be able to have milk and other dairy byproducts, you know, on a regular basis, and I'd give one to a needy family or to an orphanage and so on and so forth. And he said, well, what would you do if you had two coats? And the guy just thought for a second. He said, well, I'd keep them. He says, well, why would you do that? He says, well, because I own two coats. In other words, he didn't own two houses, and he didn't own two cows, but he owned two coats. And I think we've all kind of fantasized about this. What would we do if we had $1 million, if we had won the lotto, if we had a lot of extra money, you know what I mean? And it's really easy to give away money you don't have, right? It's really easy to be generous in your imagination of what you would do if you had a lot of money. But, you see, this fable, you know, kind of brings it out as far as what human nature is really like. In other words, what we do have an opportunity to give what we and our excess, a lot of times I think we rationalize an excuse where we don't give when we could. We only think that, well, what we would do if we were in a better position. And let's face it, it's very easy to give away something you don't have. That's why, you know, these politicians can never stop giving away our money, because it's not their money. So there's just, they're bankrupting the state, they're bankrupting the country, they're bankrupting, why? Because they have a model, basically, that don't just stand there, spend something, and that, you know, that's their model, because it's not their money, it's our money, it's from our sweat of our brow, so it's very easy to give that away. But when it comes to giving your own substance, that's a totally different story. And God really does look at our giving. I mean, I think it's very interesting if you go into, I think it was the Gospel of Luke, where Jesus was in the temple area with his disciples, and he was observing people putting in money in the treasury for the upkeep of the temple. And he watched this widow, this elderly woman, put in one mite, or, you know, which would probably be the equivalent of our penny. And he called his disciples together, and she said, "Did you see that widow who put that mite in there?" She says, "She's given more than all the rest," because Jesus knew that that was all that she had. Where other people were giving out of their abundance and other surplus, this woman was really giving something that cost her. And the fact that Jesus observed that and he commented on that tells me that he does take note of what we do with our money and how we utilize our money. Now, I would like to say something up front when it comes to money. The Bible has no qualms about people being prudent about money. I mean, if you need to have a savings account, you need to prepare for the retirement, prepare for the future, or, you know, for your college, your kids' college education, whatever it is like that. God expects us to be prudent about it. But at the same time, if we're going to be miserly with what God has given us, then we're in a situation where we're not going to be blessed, and actually we're going to be judged by it. I think you go back to the book of James, and James talks about in the last days, he says, "Come and weep and wail, you rich, you know, men who have stored up all of your treasure for the last days." He says, you know, it's become moth-eaten, and it's become rusted, and it's going to be a witness against you and consume your flesh like fire. And I'm looking at our society today, our world today, our country today in particular. I mean, we have more multimillionaires today than ever before in history. I mean, it's just... and not only millionaires, I mean, it's multimillionaires, and now there's billionaires that are becoming more and more frequent. And what are these people doing with their money? I mean, I remember reading an article a long time ago about one of these actors, multimillion-dollar actors, and he had a fleet of limos, and one of his limos, he even had a hot tub. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm not trying to be anybody's judge, but I just feel like that's really not the way to use your money. Now, I'm not saying, well, you need to give it all away to the poor, and you need to be, you know, that kind of stuff. But I'm just simply saying, hey, you got to take that money, and you better invest it for the honor and glory of God somehow. Because what happens is, if you're just going to keep it unto yourself, it's going to be a curse to you. As a matter of fact, when we get to the end of this chapter 8, Paul makes reference to the fact that he goes back to Exodus, I think it was chapter 16, where he makes a parallel between... the time in Exodus where people would gather up the manna. He said that those who gathered much, you know, had nothing left over, and those who gathered little were not lacking. In other words, if you read the story in Exodus, what happened is that God told the people, go out and gather for one day. Just gather enough for one day. Except on Fridays, where you were to gather a double portion, because he didn't want them doing work on Saturday. So some people would go out there and they just hoarded. I mean, they would gather up as much as they possibly can and fill their jars and and they had way more than they needed. Well, the next morning, all that was left over became rancid. It became, you know, odious. It became a stench. They had to throw it out. And God was giving them a real, I think, concrete lesson. Hey, man, you're storing up this out of your selfishness, and this is going to come back and be a curse to you. And I think this is what's happening in so many people today. These multimillionaires. I mean, you wonder, well, you know, why don't you do something with your money that's going to glorify God? Now, I'm not the kind of person that feels like, well, you should give your money to these poor people and those poor people, because that might not be the wise thing to do either. But I'm thinking that you should invest that money in such a way that it becomes an honor to God somehow. You know, you don't have to give away all your money either, but I'm just simply saying the Bible has a lot to say about stewardship. And this is what we're reading here tonight is about stewardship that Paul gets into as far as how to handle the money and what how we're going to be accountable for. Anyway, he says here in that in that verse 5, I just want to make a comment about that. It says, "And this not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God." In other words, they wanted to give to the Jerusalem church, but he makes reference to the fact that they first gave themselves to the Lord, and they were committed to, you know, Paul's teaching and preaching. And I think that's significant because what we do really, the motives of what we do really matters. In other words, there are a lot of secular organizations today who are raising money for this cause or that cause or this situation or that situation, and a lot of it's done out of just purely secular or humanitarian reasons. And I'm not trying to put them down, but I'm just simply saying, hey, we're not dealing with the root of the problem. In order to be really effective in the world today, we first have to be committed to God in order to really be able to help man with the right motives and be able to help them in a way that really is helpful. I didn't want to get off on a tangent on that, but I wanted to bring it to the point where Jesus talked about, hey, if you give even a cold glass of water in his name, it won't lose its reward. To me, that says a lot. It has to be in his name in order to really get a reward for it. Otherwise, you have your reward. Just like Jesus said, hey, when you give alms, don't stand on a street corner and blow a trumpet and let everybody see what you're giving and how much you're giving. He says, well, because I tell you right now, you have your reward. You receive your reward because you're out there just for the attention of men. And that's what I see a lot of these humanistic or secular programs do. It's not for the honor and glory of God. A lot of us is just to promote somebody or some group. And I don't want to be their judge, but God certainly is going to be their judge, and he's going to judge motives. Anyway, that's why it's really important to give yourself to the Lord when it comes to utilizing your resources for his glory. Anyway, he said in verse 6, he says, "Consequently, we urge Titus that as he had previously made a beginning, so he would also complete in you this gracious work as well. But just as you abound in everything, in faith, in utterance and knowledge, and in the earnestness and in the love we inspired in you, see that you abound in gracious work also. I am not speaking this as a command, but as proving through the earnestness of others the sincerity of your love also. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, that you, through his poverty, might become rich. And I give my opinion in this matter, for this is to your advantage, who were the first to begin a year ago, not only to do this, but also the desire to do it, but now finish doing it also, that just as there was the readiness to desire it, so there may also be the completion of it by your ability." Now, he says a couple things that I think are really significant. First of all, he makes a comparison. He's talking about being generous. He makes a comparison of God being generous to us in the way that he has given. You know, let's face it, God doesn't need our money any more than he needs a headache. I mean, if he rained down manna from heaven, he could rain down $100 bills. And so I think of God, I think, well, if I was in a position where I could just snap my fingers and I could have as much money as I would ever want. I mean, if I could just have money materialize in my life, I could just give my money away. I could just throw it around like confetti. I could just give it to any Tom, Dick, or Harry. I could just give it away all day long, and it wouldn't cost me a thing, would it? I don't know if you're following what I'm trying to say here. I'm just simply saying that when you look at God in one perspective, you say, well, God has everything, and if he ever had a need, he could just speak it into existence. So how does it cost him anything? Well, if you look at what it cost Christ to save us, he was rich, but he became poor. And then the cost of our salvation cost him his life, his very life. Then you begin to see the generosity of God. You begin to get a glimpse of it, because it says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Well, what Paul is making reference to here, I think he's trying to make the application that we need to be generous like God. We need to give, and yeah, give till it hurts, so to speak. That's the reference he's making here. But also in verse 10 and 11 and 12, he's talking about, okay, they started this project over a year ago, and it kind of got left on the back burner. And now the Paul is getting wind of the fact that they were, you know, very enthusiastic of completing this work. And I think that that's very significant as far as our Christian walk, because if we start something, we really do need to finish it for God. I really firmly believe that. I mean, if you commit to doing something, I think you need to follow through with it. And you know, regardless of the price it's going to cost you. I know that we got a retreat coming up, and I know that it's always difficult. It's never easy for me to be the retreat director and to try to, you know, put together the newsletter, to put together the program, and then, you know, worry about the finances, and then, you know, try to put together a sermon, you know, and then organize the whole thing, and then always be concerned about, like I said, the attendance and so on and so forth. And I would like to be able to just skip it all. I tell you the truth, I really would, because there's a lot of work involved. But hey, I committed to this years ago, and I just feel like, hey, if you commit to something, then you need to see it through. You need to follow through. If it's going to cost you something, which it should, then you know you need to be committed to that, because I really do believe that we will be judged by that. I mean, you know, I know that. A lot of times people want to flake out on it, but I just feel like, hey, you know, if you committed to this work, then you need to finish this work. And that's, you know, I think what Paul's saying here in a roundabout way, that even though it's going to cost you something, see it through. Because I don't think that God is going to reward us for good intentions. He's going to reward us for following through. I think it was Watchman Nee said something to the effect that if all the one talented Christians in the world would go forth and use their one talent, we could turn the world around overnight. But all the one talented Christians, not all of them, of course, but a very great number of the one talented Christians, rather than using their talent, they bury that talent. And they just feel like, well, the person with five talents and ten talents, you know, the Billy Grahams and the Chuck Swindolls and the, you know, James Dobson, these are the people with the ten talents, you know, let them do it. But it's really in the grassroots level where if everybody with the one talent would just use their one talent, they could make an impact very significant upon our world. The problem is what's happening. People with the one talent bury their talent. And remember, Jesus gave the parable of the one talent, and he gave it in two different places at two different times, and he used two different analogies. In one of them, he said the individual with the one talent, he kept it in a handkerchief. And when the master inquired about his talent, he says, I knew you were a demanding and exacting man, reaping where you didn't sow and sowing where you didn't reap, so here's your money back. And he gave it back to him. Of course, the master says, you worthless and wicked slave, you should at least take my money and put it into the bank. And then in the other parable, he talked about how the guy took the one talent and he buried it. One guy kept it in a handkerchief, another guy buried it in the ground. I think it's very significant is that some people can keep their talent nice and clean. In other words, they are quote unquote religious. They'll sit like a cabbage in a pew week after week and they'll never do anything. They, you know, in other words, they keep it clean. They don't live an overtly sinful life, but they're not doing anything for God with the talent that he's given them. Then the other person will take the talent and they'll bury it in the earth or the ground or the world. In other words, they'll just, instead of using it for the honor and glory of God, have soiled it, in a sense, with doing whatever with their talent that God has given them for their own selfish means. Well, both of them end up being severely rebuked by the Lord. See, so how many one-talented Christians you know, are simply sitting on their talent, simply burying their talent, rather than acting as a wise steward or a good steward with what God has given us. You see, and that, you know, that just boils down to simply, hey, putting one foot in front of the other and utilizing it. Like I said, I mean, I don't feel like I'm the 10-talented person. I'm not even the 5-talented person. I'm a one-talented person. That's all I am. I got one talent, and I'm trying to use it the best I know how to use it. For the glory of honor of God. I've been doing it for 32 years. I lost track. Over 30 years, okay? Teaching the Bible study. And I'm not a household name. Nobody knows me, which is fine with me. But it's just, I feel like, hey, if we're going to just use the one talent, you know, whatever you do, don't bury it. And it's going to cost you, like I said. I mean, I can't think of one Bible study that I haven't felt like I'm really enthusiastic about. In other words, most of the time, I just feel like it's a sacrifice. I mean, I'd rather go to bed early, or I'd rather, you know, just simply relax, sit down, have dinner, watch TV or whatever, you know. But instead, I want to use that one talent, you know, because I know that I'll have to give an account for that. And that's what I think that Paul is driving at here when he's talking about finish the work that you started doing. Anyway, let's just pick up over verse 11. It says, now finish doing what is doing it also, that just as there was the readiness to desire it, so there may be also the completion of it by your ability. For if the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a man has, not according to what he doesn't have. For this is not for the ease of others, and for your affliction, but by way of equality, at this present time, your abundance being a supply for their want, and that their abundance also becoming a supply for your want, that there may be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little had no lack. And that's what I was talking about, what he's written about in Exodus. But what's significant here is he's talking about the fact that, okay, he wants them to give generously to the people in Jerusalem, but he says it's not going to be for their ease. In other words, the money wasn't going to be taken from them and given to these people in Jerusalem and cause an affliction upon the people who give it and make the other people at ease with it. He said he wanted it for equality, but let me clarify that, because this is what these politicians do constantly. We're always hearing this never-ending drumbeat, this never-ending mantra that we need to take from the rich and give to the poor, right? In other words, tax the rich, tax the rich, tax the rich. You know, but that's man's way of trying to make things equal. And yet I look at man's way and I just see, boy, that's a big, enormous mistake. Because people who are just giving something for doing nothing, you know, they don't appreciate it, for one thing. They really don't appreciate it. And then they come to expect it. They are entitled to it. Then they want more and more and more for doing nothing. Now, I'm certainly all for giving a person a hand up in their time of need. I am perfectly fine with that, and I'm perfectly fine with helping people who are unable to work, who are physically or mentally handicapped to the degree where they're unable to work. You know, then I feel like, okay, that's where the church needs to step in, not the government,
right,
to help to these people. But, of course, we've completely destroyed a whole generation of people with just throwing money at them. Because, you know, God could see, hey, this is not the way you do things. When he's talking about equality here, he's talking about these people in Jerusalem, you give to them, but in your time of need, they will give to you. See, this is what he's talking about. In other words, these people in Jerusalem may be able to meet your spiritual needs through prayer and fasting, whatever else, and you can meet their material needs through this monetary help or this compensation or whatever. So what he's saying is this is the type of equality he's talking about. In other words, helping one another. Well, you don't see this in this asinine way that our government does things. We all have different abilities, and we're, you know, what I'm saying is there are always going to be people who achieve, and there's always going to be people who make more. The concept isn't take from these people who have achieved and give it to these people who, you know, who do nothing. Unfortunately, this is where we're at today, and we can see the end result of it, is that we've got generation after generation after generation on welfare, and they have no incentive to get off work. This is man's way of doing things. But you go back into the Old Testament, you look at God's way of doing things. He said that the people who had their land, he said that when you go through and you reap your crops, he says you can only go through one time. And you can't touch the corners of your fields. If you go through your orchards, you can only go through your trees one time and, you know, reap your harvest. And everything else that's left there is you're going to leave it for the poor, you're going to leave it for the widows, you're going to leave it for the orphans, you're going to leave it for the stranger or the alien. But they have to go out there and get it for themselves. You know, he didn't tell these people, we'll gather up all this stuff and then go out and give it to these people, because God knew, hey, people have to work for what they get. Otherwise, they will become ungrateful pigs. When you look at what Paul is talking about here, as far as he didn't want to create a situation where it would be for the ease of others and the affliction of others. He wanted it to be for the equality, where they would do this for them and their need, and they would do this for them and their need. You know, he wanted them to be working as a body. You could see, to me, the wisdom, the divine inspiration here when you read this. Paul told us in Timothy, he says, "He who will not work, neither let him eat." Can you imagine if we ran this country like that? Hey, I mean, I guarantee you, if we really, really saw that through, we wouldn't have a fraction of the poverty that we have today. We wouldn't. He who will not work, neither let him eat. Now, the way he words it is very, very important. He didn't say, he who cannot work, neither let him eat. But he who will not work. And we see a multitude of people like that today. Anyway, he says in verse 15, "As it is written, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little had no lack." And if you go back into Exodus 16 and you read the situation or the circumstance there, it was those people who hoarded, it went rancid on them, went bad on them. And those people who went out there, who gathered what they needed for a day, they never lacked. They had what they needed. This is what Jesus, when he taught us to pray, he says, "Give us this day our daily bread." Hey, I admit to you, I would like to say, "Well, Lord, give me the next couple of years in advance." You know, I mean, that's just typical of human nature, because we like to have that kind of sense of security or whatever, you know, have a nice nest egg. But what we need to do is just pray for the needs for the day. Then he says in verse 16, he says, "But thanks be to God, who puts the same earnestness on your behalf in the heart of Titus, for he not only accepted our appeal, but being himself very earnest, he has gone to you of his own accord, and we have sent along with him the brother whose fame in the things of the gospel has spread throughout all the churches. And not only this, but he also has been appointed by the churches to travel with us in this gracious work, which is being administered by us for the glory of the Lord himself, and to show our readiness, taking precautions that no one should discredit us in our administration of this generous gift, for we have regard for what is honorable, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. We have sent with them our brother, whom we have often tested and found diligent in many things, but now even more diligent because of his great confidence in you. As for Titus, he is my brother and fellow worker among you. As for our brethren, they are the messengers of the churches, a glory to Christ. Therefore, openly before the churches, show them the proof of your love and our reason for boasting about you." Now, what he's basically saying here is that he's going to send one of the brothers, who's a well-known brother, but I don't know, I guess in Corinth they didn't really know him, because he doesn't even mention him by name. Probably wasn't somebody like Apollos, because they knew Apollos, but he was apparently someone who was well known within the churches as being a very honest, upstanding, hardworking, committed Christian. So they're sending him along with Titus to take the money and transport it to Jerusalem, because he says he wants to do everything in such a way that it's above board, that they don't give any cause whatsoever for suspicion that this money was going to be siphoned off by Paul or somebody else and used for other means other than for what he claimed it was supposed to be used for. This is why when you look at what happens in some of these scandals, like Jim Baker, I mean, I guess he's out of jail now, but totally misappropriating the funds that were being sent to him, and using it for everything from a mansion of a doghouse with an air conditioner in it and stuff like that. I mean, these are the kind of things that just send me through the roof. I mean, I get so angry about that, because what does it do? It gives God's enemies occasion to blaspheme, and they turn around and they make a complete mockery of Christianity, saying it's all, they're all a bunch of suckers and being led by these people who are duping them. I remember, like, the Madeleine Marie O'Hare, I mean, she's been dead for a while now, but I remember she had such a contempt and hatred for the gospel, for Jesus Christ, for Christians. And her son, when he became a Christian minister, she says, "Well, I'm really glad for you. Now you can get into part of that money." and get it for yourself too. I mean, it's very, very cynical, but it said a lot in terms of what some people think about the church and the way they handle money. They think, well, these people are just out for your money; they're just out to get rich. And I look at like Billy Graham, for example, when he goes to, you know, to one city after another, he will publish in a newspaper the following day everything that he received, all the money that he received, and every dime and how it was spent. And that's what you need to do. You know, there's an old saying. He says, never stoop to tie your shoe in the middle of a melon patch. And what it means is, you know, don't do anything that's going to cause suspicion, where people think, well, he's stealing. You know what I'm saying? And so that's why you have to be really up and above board. That's what Paul is saying, that he wants to do with God's money here. That he wants to, and wants to handle in such a way that no one could bring discredit to the gospel by saying that, hey, you know, that money that was supposed to go to Jerusalem, hey, the guy just bought himself a yacht with the money, you know what I'm saying? And somehow he justified it. What was the old saying? Why should the Lord have junk or something like that? You know, this is what Jim Baker was saying. In other words, why he would go ride around in his Rolls Royces and have his Rolex watches and have his mansions here and a mansion there. Why should God have junk? Well, you know, isn't, I mean, but to me, it was like he was taking people's money left and right and just living high off the hog and bringing a tremendous scandal. And, you know, of course, he ended up in prison because of it. But these are the type of things that really discredit the gospel. When ministers don't display solid stewardship when it comes to the things of God. And that's what he's dealing with here. That's why I think, to me, it's very, very practical in the way that he's presenting this. Of course, you know, it may not have a lot of spiritual meat to it, but I think that the principles that are set forth in this chapter 8 and this chapter 9, I think that the church as a whole would really adhere to these things and really be, I think, diligent in making sure that every penny that is collected for the honor and glory of God goes exactly for that. The church wouldn't be in such a mess today. You know, I've said many, many times, I've quoted Hudson Taylor, especially when it comes to times for retreats. He said, God's work done in God's way will not lack God's provision. And that's why I always feel like, okay, if we do it God's way, the money will come. You know, and so I don't really make a big spiel for money at the retreats or anything like that, even though that, you know, our last retreat cost us like over $12,000. I just feel like, hey, if you do it God's way, the money will come. I do get kind of annoyed if I go into a church and you just hear the never-ending drumbeat asking for money. Because I just figure, hey, why don't you go out and just preach the gospel and the money will come. You know, I think that there's nothing wrong with making an appeal. Paul made an appeal for money. There's nothing wrong with doing so. But I really think that if this year becomes your focus, like it used to be Oral Roberts used to drive me up the wall. Because he couldn't read the slightest passage of Scripture without somehow asking for money. Well, listen, I know that, you know, there wasn't a lot of spiritual meat to this, what we read tonight, but I think there's a lot of practical things that are set forth here in our everyday life, especially when it comes to stewardship, because we are going to have to account for what we do with the talents and the resources and the time that God's given us in life. So anybody have anything you want to share?